and kitchens on the ground floor and in the basement. When we rolled into the driveway, I knew this was going to be a big one. Now, difficult though it may be for some listeners to believe, in 2002, there was no Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, or iPhone. Despite these primitive conditions, word had ricocheted around Detroit that rock was throwing a shakedown, and the place was crawling with strippers and singers and hippies and roadies and every hanger-on in between. Rock's party marked the first time I had seen cocaine, and it was a few of the local dancers who were leading the revolution, so to speak. Even though I was at a party that America's Badass was throwing, I was certainly a little bit shocked, and also curious. This was like a party you'd see in the movies, with couples drifting off into bedrooms and more coke appearing. It was like the Mark Wahlberg movie Rock Stars. Bobby ended up jamming and playing a few songs which Chelly jumped in to sing along with him. As I've mentioned, Chelly was an Olympic-class drinker, and so was Rock. And so were a lot of the Red Wings. I couldn't drink like these titans, so by 3:30 a.m., I was in better shape than most of them. And that's when I usually did my best work with whatever babe with whom I was planning my immediate future. Remember, I was 22 years old and single. I was hanging out with a bunch of legends. Plus, I had solid credentials of my own, young and single. I was not going to dismiss such cosmic generosity and enjoyed the bounty bestowed upon me. Of course, bounty goes both ways, and I soon got my chance to give back to the cosmos at one of the more beloved NHL traditions, the rookie dinner. It's beloved only by those who are not NHL rookies, because they don't have to pay for it. The rookie dinner is a chance for the team's veterans to get blind drunk on the most extravagant food and wine known to mankind while the rookies pay the freight. And when you're a rookie on the 2002 Red Wings, you're buying dinner for a team of superstars with very expensive taste. I didn't really mind my NHL initiation, though, because, after all, it was an NHL initiation and not some hazing into a college fraternity. My rookie dinner happened in Vancouver in November 2002, when I was technically no longer a rookie, but it would have been dickish to dwell on that, so I sucked it up. We all went to a restaurant called Gotham in the city's funky Yale Town district, and they gave us a room to ourselves downstairs. I can't remember what I ate, but I do remember the bill, $22,000. By the time we'd finished, my teammates had bought everything in the restaurant, including the fucking steak knives. And here's the problem. We only had two rookies, me and Jason Williams. And Jason Williams was my roommate, the roommate from hell. When I entered the NHL, only guys who'd played 600 NHL games or logged 10 years in the league could get their own room on the road. After the 2012 collective bargaining agreement, only kids on entry-level contracts got roommates, and the rest of the team could dance naked to MTV in the middle of the night in a 5-star room of their own if they wanted. But back then, pretty much everyone was bunking up. I had roommates on the road when I started out, and for a while, they were a rotating cast. But then I got saddled with Jason. On the surface, we had a bit in common. We played against each other in junior in the Ontario Hockey League, me with Owen Sound and then Kingston, and him with the Peterborough Petes. He also signed with Detroit as an undrafted free agent, just like I did, which is unique. He was a highly skilled center with a huge shot, and at this point in my life, I can't stand him. I can honestly say that I would not have shed a tear if Jason Williams choked on a bone at the rookie dinner and we lost him. Yes, I know, that is a terrible thing to say, but I thought he was a kiss-ass one-dimensional automaton. Jason Williams was the type of guy playing on a team all by himself who rubbed pretty much everyone the wrong way, and I know something about that. Williams is a weird dude, was something I heard many times that season. But on this night, what I heard from him when the bill arrived was, "How much can you pay?" I had an upper limit of $8,500 on my credit card, and it was already carrying some charges, and Williams was in the same deep hole. So between us, the best we could do was put up $16,000. A difference of $6,000 between what you have and what they want is a little more than you can work off by hosing down plates in the kitchen. But we got bailed out by one of the veterans who quietly paid the difference. No one ever stepped up to claim it, but I'm almost positive it was Nick Lidstrom. The dinner was also notable for the fact that midway through it, some beautiful Vancouver women showed up to join in the festivities. Chelly had been out sampling Vancouver's waters in the afternoon, and he'd invited some ladies to join us at the rookie dinner, so in they came for the dessert course. After dinner, the guys wanted to have a nightcap, and there were two expeditions in search of two very different pleasures. A bunch of us went to a sports bar on Robson Street for a drink, while others went to a legendary Vancouver spot, a place that has swallowed hundreds of per diem envelopes over the years, called the Swedish Touch. They don't have any actual Swedes working at the Swedish Touch, which is on the fifth floor of a building on Hornby Street. It billed itself as a massage parlor, but its services are rumored to be more comprehensive. Back in 2002, I was too young to even understand what this place really was, and besides, I had just maxed out my credit card. Plus, I preferred the excitement of going to a bar filled with people who'd be impressed to see the Detroit Red Wings roll in, as opposed to a small private room with Ilsa. Some players preferred to have their hangovers massaged out with a trip to the Swedish Touch to standing in a crowded bar with all these adoring people and working on a new hangover. Even so, at that point in my NHL career, I wondered why they hadn't wanted to come with us and get all that attention. To think that the guys had the balls to go there is mind-blowing, especially these days when even thinking about walking in would somehow result in a photo of your thought on Instagram or Twitter. It was a great night, though, and the only NHL rookie dinner I have ever had to pay for. As a measure of how good it was, we got shit-kicked the next night by the Vancouver Canucks 4-1. I realized that my identity in the NHL was coming into focus when I heard that GM Kenny Holland had told one of the kids in the system, Nick Cronwall, to stay away from Sean Avery. Cronwall wanted to hang out with me, but the Red Wings didn't want me to mentor anyone. I took it as a point of honor, as it meant there was only one me, and I couldn't teach me to anyone. Of course, it could have also meant not to get too close to me because I wasn't going to be around for long. I played 39 games for the Red Wings in my second season. But in March 2003, Darren McCarty came back from an injury, and I got hit again by hockey math. I was sent down to Cincinnati because we had too many healthy bodies. I was pissed off, because even though I've known since December that I'm an NHLer, I'm still the kid on a roster of stars. Holly said, "See you in a few days," when I packed up my gear, and that made me feel better. I went back down and played my ass off. It was actually fun, because I got a lot more ice time, got on the power play, and was able to show off my NHL pedigree in the AHL, confident that I wouldn't be down there for long. And I wasn't. After practice, Danton Cole, who is now the Cincinnati coach, calls me into his office and tells me something shocking. I'm not going back to Detroit. I've been traded. I had no idea. No one had told me I was on the trade block. No coach, not my agent, nobody. And even if you know it's coming, "you've been traded" are scary words for any player at any level to hear, because it means your life can get much better or much worse. And right now, I don't want to leave Detroit. I want to get the hell back to Detroit. And yet, I crave the chance to get a real shot with an up-and-coming team. But I hope to hell it's not Carolina or Columbus, because I don't really see my world expanding by playing in either town. But no, I hear three magic words as to where I'm going. Los Angeles Kings. And they're sending Matthew Schneider, one of the highest-scoring American defensemen in history, along with a first-round pick, back the other way. It was clear that the Wings were going for another cup, and so traded my promise for a proven veteran. And I was going to a team that would give me lots of space to shine. Suddenly, I feel like my stock in the NHL has shot way up. Actually, my reaction was more like, holy shit, buckle up. I'm returning by invitation to that crazy world I tasted at Chelly's beach house party. And now it's going to be mine. All my hard work is about to pay off in the SoCal sun. Chapter 8. Becoming a King. The LA Kings give me a few hours to drive to Detroit and pack up the rest of my gear. Chelly and Hully and the guys are happy for me, saying, "You lucky fucker, you're going to LA." They wanted me to succeed and recognized that I was getting my shot with a young team in a great city. I then caught a flight to meet the Kings in Tampa Bay for a game the next day. I landed late that night, and when I checked into the team hotel and opened my room's door, I meet my new roommate, the captain, Mattias Norrström. Now you might wonder, what GM would have the balls to room his captain with a 22-year-old he'd just traded for? It was a numbers game. At that time in the NHL, players didn't get their own rooms. So when I landed, Matty Norrström was without a roommate. Matty's a very cool guy and didn't seem to be bothered that they were putting him with the new guy. But I couldn't imagine Detroit doing that to Stevie Y. It was pretty clear that I was going from a culture of winning in Detroit with a team of veteran superstars who will do whatever they need to do to win, to a culture of, well, not winning yet. Even so, I was excited to be there because I was going to get a chance to play. Now, here's a strange thing. You would think that when you change job locations, the new office would welcome you to the fold and introduce you to everyone. I mean, that's what would happen in pretty much any job you could name. It's not what happens in the NHL. Trades happen so routinely and guys get called up all the time. So there's not any kind of welcoming committee on any team because players and coaches would be distracted from the job at hand. When I walked into the LA Kings dressing room for the first time, we were on the road and everyone was busy. So I did what all players do. I went and found the trainer and told him how I liked my skates sharpened, what sticks I used, and so on. It was all very businesslike. Then I said hello to the guys passing by me, and then I put on the uniform and played. As I had not played against the LA Kings before, there was no one on the team who wanted to kill me. Yet. After the first game in Tampa, I go out with my new teammates to a local bar around the corner from the team hotel. Just like I'd done 100 times before. Hockey players having fun after a game we'd won 4-2. I wound up pulling one of the waitresses back to the hotel and we start out in the hot tub outside by the pool, before eventually making our way upstairs to the room, where we go straight into the bathroom so I don't wake up the captain, who I'm sure thinks I'm a total fucking nut by now. But he never says a word to me about it. In fact, all he says to me the next day is, "Pass me the black tape." This is 3 hours after I was fucking the barmaid on our bathroom vanity. When I land in Los Angeles, I check into the Hilton Garden Suites beside the practice rink in El Segundo, which is between Manhattan Beach and Venice Beach and beside LAX Airport. I immediately start looking for a short-term rental as well as a rental car so I can dig into the LA lifestyle. I need a Porsche, but I can't afford a Porsche. I can afford shorts and flip-flops and love the feeling of strolling into practice like I'm going to a day at the beach. I wore number 16 when I was growing up, but I'm not going to get that number with the Kings because it belonged to the great Marcel Dion and it's hanging from the rafters of the Staples Center, never to be worn again. Hockey players generally want to keep the same number, and I've always worn 16 because that was Brett Hall's number. In fact, you don't usually have a choice about your number until later in your career, or unless you're a high draft pick. I get lucky, because number 19 is available, and that was Steve Yzerman's number, and I loved him. You can't pick your coaches either. My new coach, Andy Murray, is one very strange dude. It's as if he's an alien impersonating a human and not doing a great job of it, and that's just my first impression. He seems to think I just wandered in off the street. He has no interest in how I'm settling in. He just tells me to talk to the trainer and to see assistant coaches Mark Hardy and John Van Boxmeer to go over the power play and penalty kill. And that's it. I find a place to live right on the ocean, on the border between Venice and Santa Monica. It's a fully furnished, short-term rental that I can pay month to month. I also rent a Cadillac Escalade, which I know, is not the best car for Cali because it's a real gas guzzler and you have to drive everywhere in LA, even to get a jug of milk. But I need something to drive, and I realize very quickly that this town is all about the show, and that the valet parking game is where it starts. This means that the vehicle in which you pull up to the club or restaurant usually dictates how long you wait for your table, or if you even get past the velvet rope, which lets the chosen enter the Magic Kingdom. And I don't mean Disneyland. This kind of social management would not fly in small town Ontario. But here, it's the cost of doing business. In LA, I connect with some of my oldest friends, guys I grew up playing hockey with and against since I was 8 years old. And I meet some new ones, Canadian guys working the LA game. Many of them had recently moved to LA to build their respective careers in the music, movie, agent game. Almost everyone started as an assistant and was learning the ropes from grizzled Hollywood vets who had the boys versed in the art of the hooker and coke dealer before their new California tans had even set in. There was Cody Leibel, whose dad, a real estate guy in Ontario, had created a travel team for Cody to play on with good players who were Toronto kids, including me. If we had a big win, he would come into the locker room and peel off crisp $100 bills for us. We were 12 years old. Cody was in LA making his way as a professional money spender. Joey Scolari was another Toronto guy, a VJ known in his Toronto life as Joey Vendetta, and now a music executive. And I met him when I got traded to LA. Same with Matt Budman. His father Michael created Roots Canada. He's become a big-shot film producer. Blake Leibel was Cody's brother, and I lived with him for a couple of months in L.A. while I was waiting to close the deal on my own house. He became a film and TV director, and in the summer of 2016, he was charged with torturing and killing his girlfriend, who had just given birth to their child. At the time of writing, the trial is still pending. I'm relieved to say that he seemed totally normal when I bunked with him, but apparently he was anything but. And then there was Lawrence Larry Longo, who I'd played hockey with for most of my life. He'd quit playing when we were teenagers because he liked food and girls too much, and he became my best friend in Los Angeles. Larry was the guy who was game for anything and who lit up any social situation. Very rarely would he not be there when I walked out after a game, and we'd go and have dinner or to a party or a concert or whatever LA had to offer. I didn't live in the King's compound in Manhattan Beach. Luke Robitaille was the only other guy who didn't live there, and would venture outside the herd as I got to know my new hometown. I was here because I played hockey, but I knew that I wanted to be much more than a hockey player. It looks like success was going to happen on the ice for sure. With 10 games to go in the season, I'm truly focused on helping this team make the playoffs because that will mean they made the right choice in dealing for me. I want to give everything I have to the Kings. So when any of my teammates score a goal, I stand up and cheer with 100% authenticity, which I can promise you is a rarity in the NHL. You may want the team to do well, but you don't necessarily want your teammates to do well. In the NHL, you get paid first and foremost for putting up good numbers. The other thing you get paid for are the intangibles, drawing penalties, winning a well-timed fight, or making a big hit that shifts momentum. Let's just say you make a lot more for tangibles than intangibles. So a player like me is never going to be fully happy when a fellow third or fourth liner scores a goal, because that just made him more valuable than me. And when you hang him up at the end of your career, It's all about how much money you can make during that career. One that can end in one quick moment in a game or even a practice when you get that injury from which you may never come back. So yes, hockey was a game I loved when I was 8, and it's a game I still love, except now I can make or lose my living by how I play it. Don't get me wrong, to be paid handsomely for playing a game I love is no bad thing. Only the most selfish players make this seem like a chore, and that reality usually catches up with them when they stop producing and become dispensable. The best pros are the guys who figure out the balance of wanting personal success versus wanting team success. I don't think my teammates ever questioned my desire to win, and I honestly think it hurt me on occasion with some guys because I was hard on them for not playing hard enough or for bailing on taking a big hit to make a play. I suppose that I'd have been better off in the eyes of many if I'd bit my tongue and played the constant cheerleader role, but that would have been dishonest. Just because you're pulling down more money in a month than most people make in a year doesn't give you the right to consider everything you do to be beyond criticism. I was there to win, and I was not cool with a teammate letting me down. The more I won, the more money I'd make, the more opportunities I'd have to explore life, and the more women I would have in bed for a night, for a week, and one day, forever. Andy Murray, my coach in Los Angeles, was, as I mentioned, a puzzle, to put it mildly. I don't really know where to begin to explain this guy, so I'll start by saying that he was fired on March 21st, 2006, even though our team was 37-28-5 and poised to make the playoffs. Why fire a winning coach? I have no idea. He was the most prepared coach I'd ever seen. He created these detailed scouting sheets that he'd slide under hotel room doors the night before a game. And they were so annoying and mind-numbing that guys would stuff towels under their doors to keep them out. Andy had a very deep voice that became very high when he got angry, so he sounded like a girl when he was yelling at us. He was 5'8 and maybe 130 pounds, and he was so pale that he was almost translucent. He always wore an LA Kings golf shirt and slacks. He looked like an elementary school math teacher who was looking for his compass and pencils to draw pretty plays. Scotty Bowman, on the other hand, looked like an MIT math professor. Andy would have had a tough time playing in a beer league because he could barely skate or handle a puck. So it was pretty rich to have him yelling at us for making a bad play or not skating hard enough. You don't have to be a hockey superstar to be a coach. In fact, it's probably better if you're not, because superstars don't have to think about how they play. But you'd better have some sense of your own strengths and weaknesses. The Kings GM, Dave Taylor, hired Andy after he won a championship with Shattuck St. Mary's, the best high school hockey team in the USA. Taylor was a mild-mannered guy who had a serious stammer that vanished only when he gave a speech. Between him and Andy, the Kings didn't present the players with anything to fear. And players sometimes need to be a little bit afraid to motivate them to find the next gear. The LA Kings drafted Andy Murray's son, Brady, in the 2003 NHL entry draft while Andy was the coach of the team. Talk about awkward. Did Andy Murray and Dave Taylor actually think people were going to believe them when they said Brady Murray was the best player available when the Kings were called to the podium to make their sixth pick of the draft? I mean, Dustin Byfuglien, Brian Elliott, Yaroslav Halak, Joe Pavelski, and Tobias Enstrom, all NHL All-Stars, were still available, and Brady Murray played 4 games for the Kings and then wound up playing somewhere in Switzerland. I never saw Andy in the weight room, and I never saw him with his shirt off or naked in the steam room or shower like you'd see other coaches. I'm pretty sure I never saw him drink a beer or a glass of wine or smoke a cigar with the other coaches around a fancy fire pit at a hotel on the road. It was very difficult for Andy to say the word fuck, and that alone was probably enough to prevent guys from taking him seriously. In fact, he never swore. He was a Bible thumper, though he never thumped it at me. If we ever saw him in a restaurant, it was extremely uncomfortable for both parties because we assumed he was counting our beers or glasses of wine. But because he rarely went beyond the rink or the hotel, it wasn't a common occurrence. Andy lived in a suite at the Hilton Garden Inn beside our practice rink, which is beyond weird when you have a wife and a family. But his wife lived back in Minnesota. I don't remember seeing her in LA at any point, which doesn't mean that she was never there, but if she'd been around even a little bit, we would have known. As much as Andy and I were complete opposites, he must have seen that I could be an effective player because I found a nice spot playing on the left wing with Eric Belly Boulanger at center and right winger Ian Lappy LaPerriere on the third line. They were both from Quebec, but really polar opposites. Lappy was charged with looking after Belly because Boulanger was very easily distracted, shall we say. He liked to have a very good time off the ice. Lappy's job was to make sure that Belly's extracurricular fun wasn't going to land him in the kind of trouble that would screw up the game of his linemate and babysitter. Belly was also a bit of a sulker at times because he had been a great offensive center, and now he was being asked to play a defensive game. But he was a great two-way player. LaPerriere played a very similar game to mine, full out, so we were a hard line to play against. But I also think Lappy didn't like me for that very same reason. I was younger and a challenger. That said, he would be the first guy into the scrum to back me up if I started something and vice versa. We are the Kings checking line, which means we're tasked with playing against the opposing team's top line. And if we do a successful job at keeping them off the score sheet, then that will almost always give our guys a much better shot of skating away after 60 minutes with a W. But we're more than clock killers. We also generate offense, and I like playing with these guys. Belly is a very good face-off man, one of the best, and so is Lappy. And when they're not fighting with each other in French, on the ice, on the bench, in the locker room, we do very good work on the ice. We were a very good line. And that was new to me because I'd found myself an NHL role. We were on the ice during the last minutes of a game to protect our lead, and people could see that I was actually an NHL player of value. I'm getting attention. I'm also doing a fairly good job at pretending that I'm not starry-eyed as I drive around Hollywood. But the truth is, I'm still so green in Cali and all that comes with it. It was a step, moving from small-town Ontario to Detroit. But this is like moving to another planet, where the rules are all about how you're seen. So I decide to make myself as visible as possible, off the ice, as well as on it. I've taken measures to fit in, starting with something I always recommend when you're new to a city or country. Make the most of your wardrobe with whatever budget you have. Your wardrobe is a big piece of your confidence, and looking good feels good. In LA, I need something efficient but stylish in an all-purpose kind of way. I'm now past the tucked-in golf shirt and slacks, which made me look like some small-town tourist. I think I'll go for a James Dean look, which is retro Hollywood, but new to me. So I buy 14 white t-shirts, 7 v-neck, 7 crewneck, in a snug size medium. 4 pairs of AG soft wash denim jeans, 2 dark washed, 1 light washed, 1 black washed, a pair of black Hugo Boss military boots, and a black leather motorcycle jacket. Didn't cost me the moon, and this uniform was actually good enough to get me into and through every single LA situation, with the exception of a funeral or the Oscars. I had read about Sunset Strip's famous club, the Viper Room, which at the time was partly owned by Johnny Depp, so I wanted to check it out for myself. I drove solo into West Hollywood in my Cadillac and pulled into the back parking lot behind the Viper Room, which despite its fame is a brick slab of a building with everything painted black, including the bricks in the awning above the black door, though the club's name is in white letters. I threw on my jacket, lit a Marlboro Red and posted up across the street to the side entrance where the doorman was manning the velvet rope. I would always scope out a new joint before attempting to get inside because in those early days, I didn't know anyone and was still unrecognizable on the LA scene. I made the call to wait it out in the line, and when I got to the front, I'd tell the doorman I was new in town playing for the Kings and wanted to hear some music. I was alone and humble, and this would be a lock for access. As I'm standing there, I see a tall guy with long, blonde, curly hair walking toward the door from the back parking lot. He's wearing tight black jeans and the classic rocker black ankle boot, and he has two women, a brunette and a redhead, walking beside him who have some miles on them, but still look good because this is L.A. They have tight frames and the mandatory augmented C cups because a big firm C is the new D. This guy steps to the side to let the girls pass through the velvet rope, and then he looks at me and does a double take. "Are you Sean Avery?" he asks, surprising the hell out of me. "Yes, I am," I managed to admit. He asks what I'm doing waiting in line in a tone you'd use to ask someone if they were crazy. I told him I was new in town and didn't know anyone but wanted to hear some music. And all of a sudden, I'm walking into the Viper Room with Bobby Carlton and his friends, past all the other people in line who are looking at me with a mixture of loathing and awe. Bobby Carlton is an LA legend who happens to be a season ticket holder of the LA Kings. He's originally from New York, and that's where he learned hockey. He started going to Kings games when Gretzky landed in LA, because that was the cool place to be. The Forum Club was a venue at the old LA Forum, and it was a genuine LA destination for the rich and the famous. There was more excess back then, and LA team owners like Bruce McNall of the Kings and Jerry Buss of the Lakers were fast and loose in ways that let sex and drugs flourish because they were living that wild life themselves. The Staples Center was not like that. But Bobby Carlton is only there for the hockey. And here, at the Viper Room, he's about to change the course of my life. The Viper Room is a music venue with two floors and bands going on both. The downstairs is more of a square box bar with tables. They're not private tables, so anyone can sit anywhere. I sit downstairs, which has a pretty small stage and also these leather banquettes in green and red and blue that look even brighter under the lights. I'm not listening to the band. I'm totally transfixed by Bobby as he tells me about his life as a recovering addict who made his money in the late 80s and early 90s as an A&R, artist and repertoire, manager for rock bands. Bobby knows everyone in the Hollywood scene. Eventually, I'll figure out that it's really pretty much a town full of empty relationships. But to me, Bobby makes every handshake and air kiss a little bit more authentic. He introduces me to all the people running the velvet ropes of the city's hotspots, and this is like gold in Los Angeles. These introductions to the gatekeepers mean that I can valet the car, then open my date's door, and waltz her up to the velvet rope. To see those friendly hands raise it up like a perfect sunrise, it makes me feel for all those guys who are left standing there holding their valet ticket with their disappointed dates, making other plans for how the evening is going to end when they're told, "Not tonight," by the gatekeepers. I know it's superficial as fuck, but if you're young and in the spotlight as an athlete, musician, actor, mover and shaker, it's the way the LA game is played. All the hotspots in LA have women running the velvet ropes, and getting to know them is a lesson in power, albeit one that is particular to Los Angeles. These girls work for the men who own these clubs and bars, and the good ones probably make $125,000 a year in salary and another $100,000 in tips. They build relationships with the stars, and often celebrities will only go to the clubs that their girl is running that night because you certainly don't want to run the risk of getting turned away by a stranger. LA insecurity is what fuels the whole circus. The door girls of LA control everything, from who gets on the covers of Us Weekly to who ends up marrying and divorcing each other. according to their introductions of male and female celebrities. I mastered the art of taking care of these girls, starting with Pantera Sarah, who was kind of the den mother to all the Velvet Rope girls in L.A. We eventually had a falling out because Justin Timberlake was in her Rolodex, and when I ended up falling for Justin's best friend's fiance, and she for me, that was the end of me and Sarah's clubs. I'd always slide a $100 bill into the girl's leather jacket when she lifted that velvet rope for me and my date. And sometimes, I'd make it a gift certificate to Barney's or a massage at Sunset Tower Spa. Both much appreciated in the how you look is who you are world of LA. I did not spend money to snag a choice table, but would sometimes be given a nice one to sit at with a few friends. I'd normally have a two-top, bar lingo which describes a small round table with two chairs. No matter what, so I wouldn't need to sit at someone's table like an annoying mooch. I also rarely brought anyone other than my date, along with the infamous Larry Longo, and this discretion in numbers was part of why the door girls respected me, because I never tried to take advantage of them. L.A., back then, was a town built on cocaine. Doing cocaine in L.A. was as common as having coffee in the morning for the rest of America. Asking for blow was as common as asking someone if you could bum a smoke. To this day, I've never done a line of cocaine. And this isn't because I was fearful of failing a drug test, because nothing would have happened to me in the NHL even if my test showed cocaine in it. The league's drug policy at the time was the same as the Stanley Cup championship in Toronto, non-existent. That changed in 2005, but when I started with the Kings, you could do any drug you wanted. I never wanted to try cocaine because I was afraid I'd like it. Although, I don't have any addiction issues, I do know that sometimes I'm excessive, even if it's just too much dessert. This means that if I have that extra helping of German chocolate cake, then I do an extra 30 minutes on the exercise bike. If I smoke a few too many cigs at a party, then I can't have a cigarette for 2 days afterwards, and I have to do extra wind sprints until then. This counterbalance strategy for dealing with an excess of vice is common to most hardcore athletes, and it's dangerous because you're pushing your body one way and then pulling it another. You can get away with it for a while, but not if you want a long career. My desire to have a long career is another reason I've never tried cocaine. I was also deterred by how stupidly people can act when they've done a few lines. What they don't show in the movies when they depict glamorous people doing coke is how dull it is to listen to them repeating the same story over and over and over again. Not that guys don't use other drugs. The best feeling in the world is when the needle plunges through the skin of your ass and you feel a burst of toradol rushing into your blood. You take it after the warm-up. 15 minutes before the game, Toradol is an anti-inflammatory drug used to counter severe pain. And once it gets in your system, you feel its magic move from the tip of your toes to the top of your ears. It's the same vibe as the scene in Iron Man when Tony Stark turns the suit on and suddenly his body is covered by this indestructible armor. You feel indestructible while having a continuous orgasm. There's nothing better. That said, it's terrible for your liver. And so during the regular season, you take it in pill form. It's the playoff injection in your butt that presents the liver damage risk. But hey, it's the playoffs. You take a lot of risks. I chuckle when I read all these stories about Toradol abuse in the NFL. The NHL makes the NFL look like amateurs in the Toradol department. My cocktail of choice during the 82-game regular season was one Toradol pill and one 30-milligram Adderall tablet, split in half. Adderall is what doctors prescribe for people with ADHD to help them focus. I'd take half with the Toradol and half between the second and third periods. The Toradol makes me feel like I can skate through a brick wall, and the Adderall acts as a stimulant, giving me that extra gear and dialing me right into the zone. Adderall is now banned by the NHL. But at the time, you could take it if you had a TUE, which means therapeutic use exemption. After we came back from the lockout in 2004, methamphetamines were banned, but Adderall was not, and so a lot of guys used it. Guys also used Sudafed, which is also a stimulant, though one that was a lot more alarming to see in action than Toradol-Adderall combo. Lots of guys on the Kings used Sudafed, and I saw some so jacked up on it that they lost their hearing. They were so wired and so shaky that they couldn't understand what you were saying to them. Toradol was the exact opposite. In Detroit, they used this thing called Power Orange, which worked like Sudafed. Even after the FDA pulled it, it could still be found in the Red Wings locker room. The NHL did drug testing at the time, but the only thing you could get suspended for was an anabolic steroid. They tested for recreational drugs, but didn't suspend you for it. There was no advance warning, and they tested us all at the same time. So you showed up to practice, and there would be signs posted directing you to the WADA, World Anti-Doping Association, people who would take your details, give you a little bottle to pee into, and direct you to a stall. You'd give them your full bottle of piss, and then they would test it. You could do it before or after practice. Sometimes there were guys who stayed 2 or 3 hours after practice just drinking liters of water in order to be able to pee. The tests were anonymous in the sense that only if something got flagged would WADA check whose urine was in violation of league policy. If they found a guy with a load of cocaine in his system, he'd get a call from the NHLPA doctor who'd talk to him about his recreational drug use, and if need be, strongly suggests that he needed rehab. But between the Toradol, Sudafed, Adderall, Vicodin, Percocet, and other PKs, painkillers, you didn't really need to buy street drugs. You could find the right state of mind right in the trainer's room. Chapter 9. Summer Schooling. We missed the playoffs my first year in LA, which doesn't feel great after staggering through a Stanley Cup parade less than a year before. But despite the fact that the Kings sent me down to the minors for a bit of playoff experience, I feel pretty good. I feel like I'm in the league for good. I've decided to stay in my old room in my parents' basement in Pickering, Ontario. I want to live like a normal person and train my ass off during the week so that when I go to the Kings training camp in September, I'll blow the other guys out of the water. Of course, I also have to drive down to Detroit to pick up my stuff from Brett Hall's place. And while I'm back in town, it wouldn't be right not to throw one last rager in that house. By the time I get to Detroit, Hull is packed up to head home to Dallas for the summer. The Red Wings ended up losing in the first round of the playoffs after the deadline deal which sent me to LA. To make my party one to remember, I round up some old friends and a couple of strangers at a bar. It was closing time, so I asked if anyone wanted to party at Brett Hull's place. Yes was the answer. Around 4 a.m., we'd reached that terrible abyss feared by all ragers. We'd run out of booze. Or almost run out. There was that magnum of champagne sitting on proud display on top of the jukebox bar. After we polished that off and the cabs had arrived to take away the last guests, I retired upstairs with a friend who taught some of the Red Wings kids at a local private school. Being old enough to hook up with that hot high school teacher, but young enough to still pinch myself about it, was the kind of cosmic synergy that made the night perfect. But not quite. That magnum of champagne was the only thing Brett had that was signed by the entire 2002 Stanley Cup champion Detroit Red Wings. Now the seal had been broken, and the bubbly consumed by his 23-year-old former roommate who'd lived above the garage, along with his merry band of guests, some of whom he didn't quite know. There was only one thing to do. I filled the magnum with 1.5 liters of water and pushed the cork back inside, which is no easy feat. I can tell you that. I still have no idea if Brett knows, though now I guess he will. I go back to Detroit twice more over the summer of 2003, and each trip has an incident that makes my departure from Motown a little ugly. First began as a golf tournament in Sarnia, Ontario, which is about an hour from Detroit. I stay at Chris Draper's home on Friday night, and we get up early on Saturday morning to drive to Sarnia to play in this charity tournament, which has a bunch of Detroit Red Wings alumni playing. I specifically asked Drapes to find out if Bob Probert is attending because of that sucker punch I hit him with a year earlier in Chicago. I don't really feel like getting my face caved in on the 19th hole. Good news, Probert isn't attending. After the golf tourney, there's a banquet. And then the bar opens and the real party begins. Local talent in the form of a group of divorced women in their early 30s arrive, and these gals are hungry. Hockey players refer to women who make it very clear that they want to sleep with a hockey player, or with any man for that matter, as hungry. Toward the end of the night, I'm in a white stretch limo. At this point in my career, I only travel in white limos. With some of these hungry ladies. And we're getting ready to head back to the hotel we're staying at when suddenly former Red Wing Dino Ciccarelli sticks his head inside the limo and asks to speak with me. I say, no problem, and step outside. Dino Ciccarelli has always been one of my heroes, and Sarnia is his hometown. Maybe he wants me to come back to a party at his place. No, he does not. In a matter of seconds, we're in an argument about whether the ladies in the limo want to go back to the party I'm throwing at my hotel or not. They do. Dino wants them to come back inside the banquet, and after he calls me a rookie, I file how much I love Dino as a player in a safe place in my head and get ready to defend myself. Dino now takes a step toward me with a hand up like he's gonna grab my shirt and then push me back, which is a classic hockey fight move. Or pull me closer to give me an earful of well-lubricated advice. Either outcome is not what I want. So with one quick move with my right hand, I slap his incoming hand down and see the blood rush to his head. Then we both push each other at that exact same moment, which moves us both back a step away from each other. Fuck it. Here we go. Outside a stretch limo in beautiful downtown Sarnia. We both have our hands up and we square off to fight when thankfully my real life guardian angel, Chris Draper, comes to the rescue to break it up and saves both of us the painful Sunday morning embarrassment that would have followed. The next and pretty much final weekend I've ever spent in Detroit began on the 4th of July, 2003. I went to a Tigers game with Chelly, Kid Rock, and John Cusack, along with some legendary guys from Chelly's Chicago crew. After the game, we piled into a rented tour bus and headed to Chelly's Chili Bar in Dearborn for a surprise Kid Rock concert. This is what made Chelly and Rock such fucking legends. Halfway through Rock's set, I go out to the bus with two girlfriends I've rolled with for a few years in Detroit, and who are truly just friends, to smoke a joint. Yes, it's true. Though I hardly drink these days, I like to burn a joint and listen to the music. The bus is deluxe. A multi-million dollar Prevo that rock stars tour in. I once smoked a joint inside Willie Nelson's Prevo, which actually has a gigantic portrait of Willie smoking a joint painted on the entire back portion of the bus. Chelly is already on the bus, taking a breather. Then this guy walks on the bus and sits down beside one of Kid Rock's buddies. The buddy politely asks the kid to leave, but the kid, he's a bit younger than me, but not that much, doesn't budge. So I stand up from the kitchen table and tell him it's a private bus and he needs to get off right now. But this guy tells us he's going to stay and hang out and asks if we're going to smoke a joint. I can't believe it. The guy stands up like he's going to walk to the back of the bus, so I move toward the front. We're just about face to face when the guy drops his shoulder, which means a punch is coming. Before he can get one off, my right hand goes from hanging beside my waist to the dead center of his face, and instantly I can feel a sharp pain shoot up my forearm. The guy is flat on his back, sucking air through his mouth loudly, deeply, and fast, but he's definitely out cold. It was the longest 30 seconds of my life before he came to and we got him off the bus and had one of the doormen put him in a cab with a $50 bill in his pocket. I woke up the next morning before my drive back to Toronto and read a text from Chelly saying that his actor buddy John Platoon Wall Street McGinley had found the guy's front tooth, root and all. I hit that guy as hard and as perfectly as possible, and it was the most expensive punch of my life because, although the cops wouldn't charge me, the kid sued me in civil court, my first lawsuit, by the way. We settled on a $26,000 lump sum payment, but I was so pissed off by the whole incident that I made the guy wait $200 a month until he tried to garnish my wages. Then I cut the guy a check. I know from experience how expensive dental bills can be, so hopefully replacing his front teeth didn't leave much for him to take a vacation to Myrtle Beach. Anyway, lesson learned. When you have money, the bullseye on your back is real, and you need to be careful. Imagine this. You're living in your parents' basement in a Toronto suburb, and Brad Norton, NHL heavyweight, master of sarcasm, barroom charmer, and all-around fucking savage, invites you to LA to go to the ESPYs. By the way, he's your roommate. You go, right? Brad is my kind of guy. The thing is, though, it means you're living in two very different worlds. This is probably true for most athletes. Most of us come from small towns, or poor neighborhoods, or poorer countries. Then we end up in chartered planes and luxury hotels and clothing stores where pants cost $750. Every big league athlete goes through it. But big league athletes who end up in LA experience culture shock of a different order of magnitude. I mean, when I head back to LA from my parents' basement, I stay at the Chateau Marmont. The place looks like a Bavarian castle sitting on a hill overlooking Sunset Boulevard. From its Gothic cloisters to its poolside bungalows, it's a magical spot where celebrities live out all the excesses they desire. When I open the patio door of my room, I look out on a garden restaurant where it's almost impossible to secure a reservation because from 8 a.m. to 2 a.m., it's filled with every major director, movie star, producer, agent, musician in town, meeting to discuss upcoming projects. In those days, they let you smoke at the fucking table. Actually, they sold cigarettes like a side dish on the menu. Joaquin Phoenix is sitting poolside drinking a Diet Coke and chain-smoking while reading what I assume is a script. At one end of the pool are a couple of guys who play in a band hanging out with LA party girls. One of the ladies orders her Diet Coke with three lemons and smokes a pack of American Spirit Yellows. Over there, a middle-aged balding man who has a stack of scripts on the table talks on the phone the entire day so loudly that everyone within a 200-foot radius can hear his bullshit. He's the same guy you always see in the boarding area at airports, who treats the entire captive audience to his stupefying speeches to some poor minion on the other end of the line. There's a supermodel drinking bottled water and also smoking a pack of cigarettes, this time Marlboro Lights. And there's an English or Australian couple who are in dire need of a few days' sun and can't stop staring at everyone and wondering if there's someone. So yeah, L.A. is not like anything life has prepared me for. In Detroit, I'd hear people talking about Michigan football and jobs in the auto industry. I may not care about football or have anything to do with auto unions, but I got it. They were talking about the same world I grew up in. In L.A., they're talking about themselves, about their summer plans and their winter vacations, and about how to burnish their image. I definitely have some insecurities when I hear people talking about places like Paris and New York and Aspen. But I've decided that the best way to deal with this sort of thing is to be honest and ask questions when I need to. I lived in West Hollywood, which is well stocked with men and women of the world who have resources and style. And I ran up against it all the time. I won't pretend to be something that I'm not, which at this point is a globe-trotting hotshot who's been around the world several times. I've only flown in first class once to model tuxedos on Good Morning America. And while that's not the measurement of success, it just goes to show you how wide-eyed I am. Still, I'm starting to feel very comfortable in my life beyond the rink. Day in and day out, I meet a lot of agents from alphabet soup agencies like CAA and UTA and WME. I meet a lot of floaters, which is a term describing a celebrity or star athlete's friend. Someone who somehow has a schedule allowing them to be by their famous friend's side at most social events. It's a very LA species, and a floater sticks out like, well, a floater in the toilet. The thing is, there's so much money sloshing around that there's a whole ecosystem of losers who thrive just by hanging around and living off handouts. Let's just say I didn't meet a lot of floaters where I grew up. But then, I didn't want to stay where I grew up, did I? I love this place more than any place I've ever been in my obviously boring life to date. Back to the ESPYs for a second. Remember who won best athlete that year? I'll give you a clue. He was later outed as an epic steroid user, along with a cocktail of other performance-enhancing drugs. Yes, it was Lance Armstrong. It was roughly around this time that people started wondering whether NHL players were on steroids and figured they should test us. But they shouldn't have bothered. Steroids work for sports where you need bulk and muscle, not for the ones where you need speed and agility. No hockey player I know has any interest in steroids. When you look at pro hockey players stripped of their gear, it's surprising to many people how lithe we are. Hockey players need to be able to skate. When some TV analyst says that a player isn't a strong skater, it's all relative. A guy isn't going to make the NHL if he's not an elite skater. That's as much about agility and balance as it is about performing one movement more powerfully than the next guy. Carrying around a few extra pounds of beef or being able to bench some ridiculous amount is only going to slow you down and make you a worse hockey player. So no, there's no steroid problem in the NHL. But life is not just smoking cigarettes by the pool or walking the red carpet with Lance Armstrong. Before I go to the ESPYs with Nordy, I head to Runyon Canyon Park, which is 160 acres of lush and rugged parkland between Hollywood Boulevard and Mulholland Drive to run vertical sprints, a fancy term for running up a hill. The first three steps you take from a dead stop to surging forward during a hockey game are the most important. Having a bomb like Shea Weber or being able to stick handle like Connor McDavid would be nice, but that's not what makes you a good hockey player. Lots of guys have great careers with those weapons, but no one sticks around if he can't control the most important thing: how far away you are from the other guy. If he's got the puck, you need to close the gap fast. If you've got it, you need to pull away before he closes the gap. If you can't do that, you're not in the NHL. Because if you can't do that, you don't have time to do anything out there. I bet most guys would trade just about anything for an explosive three strides. It's all about the gap. The moment that you know the pass is coming until the moment it hits your stick is less than 2 seconds. You've got a few fractions of a second to make an important decision. By the way, you're also skating at full speed, aware that if you're looking at the puck, there's a guy who hates you just out of your field of vision making a decision of his own. Can he run you over before you've got control of the puck? So you have to decide whether you stay wide on the defenseman or need to cut in the moment the puck hits your stick. Let's say I'm staying wide. I'm going to protect the puck by getting my inside shoulder in front of the D-man who himself has pivoted from backwards to forwards and is now skating beside me, trying to get his stick in front of the shot I'm about to take. That shot is probably less than 2 seconds away. Meanwhile, I'm trying to figure out where to put the puck. My eyes are up, looking to see whether the goalie is guessing that I'm going to cut across, whether he's tight to the post, or whether he's hedging his bets and opening up his legs to be ready either way. The game's great goal scorers can make it look slow and easy when they drop their shoulder at the goalie to freeze him, then calmly put the puck wherever he's not. But trust me, it's neither of those things. If you can't explode into open ice to take that pass, maybe you don't have the body position you need to get the shot off. Or if you arrive a fraction of a second later, maybe that defenseman has stepped up and smoked you. The difference between a guy who almost made it and a star who makes millions and hangs out in LA art galleries is a fraction of a second. This is why I run 15 5-second, then 12 10-second, and then 10 15-second sprints up a serious hill at 5:45 p.m. on a Friday in the heat of L.A. in July. I also do it because if I don't push myself up that hill, then what should be the best weekend of my life will now be a 3-day guilt trip with me unable to dodge the shadow of shame for not putting in the work. But if I survive the run, I get to head to a party at the Mondrian Hotel with Nordy. Chapter 10. The King of L.A. I truly believe what kicked off my 2003-2004 season was